Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today we have a special guest, David Goldberg. David is an executive director at UBS covering the building and building product sector. Before assuming coverage, David was an associate analyst focused on the home building companies within the sector. Prior to this, and before business school, he worked at the Convergent Wealth Advisors, a wealth management firm in Rockville, Maryland, focusing on providing independent financial advice to high net worth families. David, we welcome you to our show.
Thanks for having me.
We were reminiscing a little bit before you and I got on air about a meeting that we had. What was the year was that? Was that 2009?
That sounds right.
Okay. And because of you, I got placed with 10 of the world's largest hedge funds for dinner. And it was kind of a kick. I guess I don't know the answer to this. Why were they there? Why were they interested in talking to me? Because one thing Bill Richards said to me kind of before we sat down, he said, you know, you're probably going to be talking to $250 billion. And, you know, I don't even know how to say what that number is. It's like saying, I can't be worried if you tell me I'm going to be in 50 feet of water or 50,000 fathoms, because I'm not touching the bottom either way. So I wasn't worried, but it did occur to me, why are they there listening to me?
No, look, I mean, you know, I think at the time in 2009, and I think we saw this play out in a lot of ways, there was a lot of institutional capital that kind of understood that there was a dislocation and disintermediation in the market as it comes to, you know, there were a bunch of people who needed a place to live. There were a lot of foreclosures coming through the system. It was difficult to get mortgage loans, and that the buy for rent business was going to be a very, very massive new asset class. And, you know, we've seen a lot of companies get in that business. A lot of companies come public where, you know, whether it was American Homes for Rent, American Residential Properties, who got in the business of buying distressed properties and renting them out. So I think, you know, there was a very clear sign from the hedge fund community and from the Wall Street community generally that there was an opportunity to kind of break this disintermediation with capital and profit by doing so, and certainly a number of them have.
Yeah, quite a number, as a matter of fact. And you know, we were talking a little bit about how that started to work out and how it started to morph in other things. So now they, you know, they went from buying single family homes to loaning on them to investors. And I guess there's hybrids of both. David, is it your sense that there'll be a day when the majority of them exit their holdings, or are they almost creating scattered REITs that will just be REITs for a long time?
You know, Bruce, it's a wonderful question. It's one that we've explored, I think, quite a bit. It's very difficult to kind of know the exit strategy. And I suspect we'll probably get some sort of, you know, bifurcation in funds. I think there are some that have been formed as REITs that clearly see this as a new asset class, and they're trying to find ways to improve the efficiency of the business. You know, that was always a big concern, that, you know, instead of having a multifamily high-rise building or a mid-rise building with multifamily rentals where there was a lot of kind of natural efficiency just geographically, that the single-family detached rental business would always be an issue because the locations were scattered and it was hard to drive that from a maintenance perspective. There are companies out there that are trying to work on that, to fix those issues, to build infrastructure, to run REITs for an extended period of time, whatever that might be, 7-10 years, infinitely, who knows, and see this as a new asset class. There are others where it's less clear what the exit strategy is. I'm sure some of them would like to sell the positions. Clearly, some of the funds that got raised, you know, have definite timelines and need to return capital to shareholders at some point. But the exit strategy is a lot less clear to me when it comes to flipping the house.
And I think the fear is that they become market makers in the sense that they're going to drive the market. In a way, they were a lot of responsibility for 2013 being the up year that it was. It wasn't that they bought 80% of the properties, they just made an offer on 80% of the properties.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I would tell you is, you know, there is that fear that, you know, there's all these properties that are being held, you know, by investors and they're being held for rentals. And you have this situation where at some point in the future they have to, you know, liquidate the homes because they need to get cash back to investors and close the funds down. The only thing I would tell you is these are very, very rational investors. You know, they're not going to dump 100,000 properties on the market tomorrow. They're going to be very careful in the way that they go about executing any transactions because they do have a full portfolio behind them. So, you know, our view has been that you'll see a very rational and orderly liquidation of the supply for what gets liquidated. I think when we think about that relative to the larger housing market and towards certainly the public builders, I think we're transitioning to the next stage of the housing recovery. If the first stage was, you know, very concentrated in the best locations and very supply driven, or, you know, driven by the lack of supply, which is what drove so much of the price appreciation. The next phase, the supply constraint, you know, starts to move in the periphery. You have REOs that get brought back to the market, you know, investment properties that get brought back. You have foreclosures that are still in process that are out there. You have people who want to sell. You have a lot of vacant developed land out there in these more peripheral locations, and you have less of a supply constraint. So it's more volume-driven and less price-driven as we move forward.
Well, the big driver was, in especially in California, you could buy an existing home way below replacement cost.
Mm-hmm.
And those days probably have gone in most areas. So that when Wall Street came in, they came in later than they were invited. When I was there in 09, I mentioned to them, I thought that that would be a good idea for them to finance other investors. I really didn't know that they would ever think that this investment would be for them. But, you know, a couple of years later, they showed up and at a different price level, but it still made sense. But now, you know, they've moved on to other places. So I think the next phase might be that builders can finally make a spread again in the states that were dominated by REOs.
Well, look, I think that's right. I think we're kind of slowly progressing towards that. You've seen the builders try to build product that will be competitive, you know, even at maybe a little bit higher price than what's out there on the existing home market, but a competitive price. When I talk about the next stage of the recovery, we think about the kind of spread geographically and, you know, maybe a little bit less of California specific, but, you know, you think about California, you think about kind of going more inland. In areas like Phoenix, it's going a little bit away from the kind of core centers, where the A, B locations where people want to be. I think the entry-level buyer is kind of the next big part of the market, and it's a geographic spread issue as we get into kind of the CD locations. That's where the REO, in my mind, is primarily, you know, what was REO at one point is primarily located. It's rental properties now, and I think that helps take the supply constraint away a little bit. So, you know, when I look at what happened in 2013, I see, especially in better locations where the builders were building, massively supply-constrained areas with very low rates, which drove, you know, demand was above supply, and it was very high-quality demand. And so there was a lot, not very much price sensitivity. I think price sensitivity is increasing in the market today.
When you mentioned the entry-level buyer, you've got to also deal with entry-level financing. So FHA financing, let's say in 2008, 60% of FHA's business was to a FICO score that was under 680. And in 2013, it was 10%. So the credit quality of that first-time buyer has changed drastically to where now they're really half of the size of the volume that they were, for California anyway, during most of the cycles that, you know, where we're in this cycle where we're coming off of a bottom and we're, you know, building momentum on price. Normally, the first-time buyer crowd is almost 45, 50% of the California market. Now they're 25. So the builder is going to be looking at that same demographic saying, okay, we might have somebody that wants one, but I don't know if they're going to get a yes answer from a lender.
Well, let's start with the beginning of the question, which I think the question is, you know, essentially what's happening in terms of marginal liquidity in the credit box. And I would tell you, as we talk to most builders across the country, and not California specifically, but across the country, we're seeing marginal easing. It is really at the margin. It is just starting to ease. You're seeing more non-QM prime loan availability. You're seeing more jumbo prime availability. You're seeing the banks want to be in that business where, you know, historically maybe they haven't been. You're seeing it in the Senior Loan Officer Survey. You're seeing it in the National Association of Home Builders Credit Availability Index. You're seeing a little bit of easing at the margin right now. It's not that significant. It's certainly not enough to drive a lot of entry-level demand, but it's getting incrementally better, and I think it's going to continue to get incrementally better. We have QM in place right now, the Qualifying Mortgage Standard. You know, the new lenders, especially non-bank lenders, are going through their audits with the CFPB. They're getting their back offices correct. They're getting their quality control checks in place. So I think the market is slowly starting to loosen, and that's a process that we're going to see continue for the next few years, because we'll be in a, you know, stable to moderately growing home price environment. Not a lot of price, but a little bit, or at least stable, and you'll see some loosening because there is a lot of opportunity. So I think the capital is getting there, but it's a very slow process to match the capital with the borrowing needs that are out there, especially given, you know, some of the trepidation, given the political landscape that is behind, you know, subprime lending or, you know, anything that's kind of non-traditional outside-of-the-box lending right now. So it's a very slow process. But I think it's starting, and we're going to continue to see more of it in 15, 16, and 17.
Where do you see the source of this capital coming from, if it isn't the government?
Yeah, Look, I think you're going to see it from a number of sources. It's not going to be banks, and I don't think it's going to be banks primarily because of capital rules. It's not so much putback risk at some point in the future. It's going to be more the way banks count, you know, securitized loans, and you think about QRM and kind of first loss risk that banks will need to take for non-QRM lending, which is going to look, I think, a lot like QM. So I don't think it's going to be driven by the banks, especially with Basel and CCAR rules and everything that's going on from a regulatory standpoint. If I had to guess, it's probably a combination of non-bank lenders. You know, there's been a number of non-bank lenders that have been formed or have grown in size pretty significantly since this kind of upturn in housing. They've essentially, as I look at it, kind of built machines to dram, you know, put a lot of volume through in terms of mortgage loans, and they've been out there. And even, you know, as we've moved through the upturn, they've been a little bit more aggressive than the banks in terms of the overlays they've been doing on FHA loans. And the next extension of that is clearly into the, you know, non-FHA, non-conventional, you know, probably non-QM, you know, line of originations. And then I think you add on top of that, we'll see some non-traditional lenders be increasingly in the game. We hear more and more about, you know, non-traditional, maybe private equity, hedge fund kind of money getting into the non-QM prime area right now. You know, self-employed borrowers that can't meet the 43% back-end debt-to-income ratio, as an example, where you can find some great borrowers that just can't get financing because it's a fairly rigid box that's being accepted now in the QM world. And I think if you add on top of that, you know, mortgage REITs will be a more important part of the business. They don't have any issues in terms of holding first loss risk, right? They're going to portfolio the loans and hold them in their portfolio. And they don't have put back risk issues and everything, right, from trying to securitize and sell the loans. I think you're going to see a combination of different sources, but it probably won't be traditional banks.
You know, you said a mouthful in a short period of time, and part of what you were talking about, when the way we were funding loans in 2004 and 5 and 6, I didn't even understand that until after that. In other words, I really didn't know what a mortgage-backed security was, or, you know, all the things that ended up a credit default swap and all that. It was almost after the fact. I think in 08, I finally went, oh my gosh. That world, does that have a chance to reemerge, or will it be what you've just said, mostly it'll be portfolio?
You know, it's a tough question, because the question really speaks to the heart of, you know, do we forget what happened, essentially? And you know, the history student in me says we always forget history.
Exactly, I do too.
right? I mean, that'd be my natural inclination. But this has been a pretty serious downturn, not just, you know, in housing and for the average homeowner and what's happened in terms of the wealth impact of the United States, but also to the banks that have taken massive write-offs and seen massive losses and seen banks go away because of it. So I think there is, especially, you know, where people's history and companies' histories might be short, the regulatory environment is changing in a way that's going to kind of keep us remembering what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be the lasting, you know, piece of this, is that even if banks want to do it, it might get tougher and tougher to go out and do that. So, look, there'll no doubt be securitizations, right? Like I said, we're already seeing some non-QM prime loan securitizations come through. We're seeing mortgage REITs get formed, raising capital, those kind of things. But it will, I don't think we'll ever get to the extent of where we were in terms of looseness at the peak of the last cycle.
It seems like the banks are now, I mean, they're getting big penalties that are getting dished out in the last year into the, what, $5 and $10 billion.
Yeah, and that's exactly the point. You know, there's been some pretty harsh ramifications, not just from the losses that were taken, but also from the subsequent penalties the banks paid. So I think that does leave a lasting memory. And you've seen, you know, frankly, some of the banks change their attitudes towards mortgage lending because of it. So I think there will be, as you look forward, to a different attitude from a lot of banks. And I don't think it's going to get back to where we were in 05 and 06 anytime in the next decade.
Okay. What is the how's the builders' outlook as far as what they see coming up in the next few years?
Moderate growth. I mean, that's probably the best way to describe the public builders for sure. They look out, they see a macroeconomic environment. So if you kind of look at the individual pieces, right, from a demand perspective, we've had decent job growth, not robust, but okay. We've had probably not enough wage inflation, which is a concern that, you know, can new households essentially afford housing? Can they come up with down payments, which seems to be the biggest impediment to the entry-level buyer? But we do see, you know, job growth, and we see wages at least kind of flat, maybe growing a little bit. They see the mortgage market loosening potentially on the margin right now. So they look at the demand picture. We've underformed households for a long time. Demographics seem to be in their favor to some extent, you know, with the echo boomers and the millennials essentially going into their 30s, into their kind of prime home building, home buying years. starting family years. And so the demand seems to be okay. It seems to be positive, not robustly positive, but still positive. And on the supply side, again, it's not like you're sitting out here with a lot of supply in the market. I think there's probably enough, especially in those kind of CD locations, to give you a nice, you know, volume recovery, but not a lot of price. But it's not like you're inundated with volume like you were before. You know, we went through kind of sweeping through a lot of the foreclosure properties and REO properties. So I think the builders see a nice moderate growth recovery, you know, ahead of them with some, you know, a slow march towards normalization, but it's going to take years to get there. And I think the builders are very cognizant of that.
When you mention CD locations, to me, that usually means distance. It's away from work centers. And almost the same mentality that drives prices way up drives that it's okay to drive that far to work decisions. So we were finishing a project in 05 that we built 93 houses. 90 of those buyers drove to Los Angeles each way, at least 90 minutes to 2 hours each way, and made that decision because prices had been exploding. So I guess those CD locations, they get affected by how exciting it is to own a home and how much people buy into the fact that it's going to keep going up.
Yeah, look, I think there is a psychological aspect. I mean, I think when you think about the two-hour commuting markets, and again, maybe looking a little bit away from California, and you think about a market like D.C., where people were buying homes in West Virginia to commute to D.C., I don't think we're going back to those kind of peripheral locations anytime soon.
Okay.
I think now it's a little bit more moving to the fringe. I mean, look, we're building 450,000 new home sales, right? I mean, we're just not building that many homes. Starts are, you know, we're sitting at about 1 million starts, but single-family starts have not moved that much off the bottom. So we're way below kind of the normal level. I just believe when you kind of look at the prime locations where people really want to live, there's not a lot of supply of housing. Prices have gone up significantly in 13 for sure. Not as much clearly in 14, kind of more stagnant on 14 prices after a huge move in 13. Rates have gone up. Rates are probably going to go up a little bit more as we look forward, especially if housing starts to recover. You start to price people out of home ownership in those AD locations. So, you know, it's going to start in C before it gets to D. And it will eventually be the pricing in C that drives people to go to D because you can't afford C anymore. But I do think the next phase, the next stage of the recovery is going to be more volume-oriented, and it's going to be in more peripheral locations.
Are the builders building a very different product than they were in the last run?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, there's a lot of ways to tackle that question. So I think, you know, first of all, from a location perspective, thus far in the cycle, the builder's been much more focused on those A, B locations where they view the land underneath that as lower risk. You know, it started off with buying finished lots, and then you ran out of finished lots in those better locations, so now it's more development-oriented purchasing they're doing. You know, they have to entitle more land, they have to develop more land. It's further out in terms of their time frame for the land itself. In terms of the homes, I would say that the builders have worked pretty hard to try to reduce some of the inefficiencies, to price the house more efficiently, more options, more upgrades, you know, looking at, you know, lot premiums, that kind of stuff, where before it was maybe, hey, look, we're building enough homes, we put granite in every house. You know, now granite's more of an option and it's an upgrade for somebody. So I think they've worked hard on the value engineering. I don't think they're certainly done with the process. They've gotten better, though. They've simplified their businesses. In terms of the homes themselves, you know, design may be a little bit different. You know, again, maybe less features in the house, kind of standard, more options, more of an option upgrade kind of model, and some simplification for sure to try to keep costs down, but nothing radically different.
Level of unsold homes, pretty safe everywhere?
Feels that way. Most builders aren't building much spec.
Okay.
I think that's another big change. You know, there's a couple exceptions of builders that tend to focus more on specs in their construction. But generally speaking, the builders are being very cautious right now.
And how sensitive do you think the builders industry is to interest rate changes?
You know, that's another really interesting question you asked, Bruce, because we get that question a lot from investors. You know, what if the 10-year is up 75 basis points? You know, what if the Fed starts to tighten and the yield curve moves up? I don't think for the entry-level buyer, and I don't want to underestimate affordability, but I don't think it's primarily an affordability issue for most entry-level buyers today. I think it's much more of a down payment issue. I think that if you were to talk to builders, and there are some builders who do, as an example, USDA financing is a good example, where that's 0% financing, it's only available in certain parts of the country, and you have to hit certain density, so it's kind of a rare product. But when you go to a 0% down payment model, demand really spikes quite a bit in the entry level. When you get to an FHA model, where you're putting 3.5% down, there clearly isn't as much demand. So I don't think it's an affordability, it's a payment issue today. I think it's much more of a down payment issue. And I think that's probably true for another 75 or 100 basis points in rates. If we keep going up from there, it gets tougher. But for the interim, I think rates are going to be okay. You know, builders can always change product. I think that's one thing that we always think about is if a buyer can afford less payment, builder can change product to meet payment. So it's always going to require flexibility.
You know, what's interesting, and I think 2000, and this may be a year wrong, but at 2010, I think we were really hurting for sales, and so we did a tax credit of $8,000, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I wonder how that pile of loans worked out, because that was basically a nothing down loan program. And I have a feeling it performed really well.
You know, I would imagine that was right. That's true what you said. It feels like the biggest problem from what I've seen, and I'm not an expert in this area, but from what I've seen from the data, it seems like the most problematic loans that were originated kind of post-upturn were the down payment assistance programs, where, you know, you had the seller donating money to a third party, a not-for-profit that was then, you know, that money was being donated for the down payment. Those seem to be problematic loans, but I would agree that the loans that were originated under the government tax credit seemed to perform pretty well. The flip side of that is, though, when you talk to the builders, it felt like the tax credit was much more of a pull forward of demand than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't really have a net impact on demand in the end.
Okay.
Especially because, remember, the buyer still had to come up with a down payment. They just had it refunded later.
Correct.
So it wasn't like you could go in. The net over time would be, the net effect, I guess, is the way to think of it, would be zero. But it still required a cash outlay up front and then a refund later. And frankly, if you talk to the builders, once that went into effect, the clamoring among the public builders, certainly, and I think the large builders in the country for another tax credit went down pretty quickly.
One of the things that's been true over the last 5 years is just there's no volatility to interests that's anything big. When I got in the business in 1981, the Fed changed the Fed fund rate 21 times that year.
Mm.
And, you know, I don't know how quickly interest rates might change, but we're certainly... We're used to a very casual market that doesn't change at all. And it's interesting, we've only got another minute and a half, but most of the time when affordability goes down, volume goes up. So everyone that's concerned about affordability is becoming less and less. There's a psychological driver to where that coincides with price increases that drives the other side called demand.
Mm.
So if you take a look at the chart of affordability and you take a price chart, it's almost, well, of course, the price chart, it goes up, affordability goes down. But if you look at the volume at the same time, the volume always goes up.
Hmm.
That's why 2000, and when you say, that's interesting because the assumption is that can't mathematically be true.
Well,
but what you and I said before is there's a human element to it.
Right.
That equation seems to play out.
Yeah, the reason I said is because it kind of pits two different thought processes, right? When you think about kind of typical end of cycle behavior, right, you typically at the end of an up cycle would have rising rates, prices would continue to follow through, so affordability would be going down, and because you're at the end of an up cycle for the macro economy, right, because housing is just leading you in the economy anyways, you're having the end of that cycle from, you know, so the affordability is going down and volumes are going up in the follow through in the cycle. And the Fed's probably raising rates because you're approaching the end of a cycle, you've been running too hot, and the Fed's trying to slow the economy down. We're in a very different market this time around. Rates are really low. The Fed's going to have to raise, but rates are so below what is normal. Right? We have a 4.5%, sub-4.5% 30-year fixed rate mortgage that the Fed raising is really kind of getting us back to some sort of normalcy. And so I wonder if we'll see a similar pattern as we move through this cycle, just because the starting point is so vastly different from when we normally start.
Yeah.
You know, I think there are a lot of people who say, oh, once the Fed starts raising, That's going to be the latter innings of this cycle. We're going to kind of hit that, you know, the fat lady's not singing yet, but we can see her coming from the distance, because historically you get that trend, right? The Fed raises at the end of the up cycle to slow the economy down. Well, now it feels like we haven't had much of an up cycle in reality, especially from a volume perspective. And clearly, I think if the Fed's raising, it might not have that same signal to the economy that this is close to the end of the housing cycle.
I think it'll drive demand, actually.
I hope so.
Great speaking with you. Thanks so much for joining us, David Goldberg from UBS.
Thanks for having me on.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.